Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Your Excellency, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, friends of Australia, the Menzies Centre for Australian Studies is delighted to be co-sponsoring tonight's book launch. My name's Simon Slight, and I'm a lecturer in Australian history across the road at King's College London. As well, come January, as acting director of the Menzies Centre during Ian Henderson, no relation to our author, during Ian Henderson's period of research leave. I'll hand over to my colleague, Professor Carl Bridge, shortly, but first, allow me to just flag up some forthcoming events which may be of interest. Tonight's launch represents the start of an exciting phase of activities for our centre. As well as the continuing renewal of our regular public seminar series on 14th of January, come April, reflections on all things Anzac deepen. On the 1st of that month, we'll be learning about the history of Anzacs in London. On the 21st of April, we'll be hearing from two academics about Anglo-Australian wartime relations. And then on the 6th of May, Professor Bruce Skates will be offering a first response to the centenary that was via a major public lecture. These are just some highlights. The Centre will also be involved with the British Museum's 2015 Encounters exhibition, with the Origins Festival of First Nations, and with the Australia and New Zealand Festival of Literature and Arts. To get involved in any of the above and more, do keep abreast of developments via our website, which is listed behind me, and also via our Facebook community. Let me now introduce Professor Carl Bridge, Professor of Australian History at King's, and a man who knows a thing or two about Menzies.
Well, thank you, Simon. I think he's the bloke that our centre's named after. We used to be called the Sir Robert Menzies Centre in the good old days, but then we were told to reduce it to keep our head below the parapet, but occasionally we can trot him out again. And tonight's one of those wonderful occasions when we can. So there he is, up there. Well, it only seemed yesterday, Anne, that we were launching Lions here. Anne Henderson and her husband, Gerard, are really the historians of the liberal tradition in Australia. They're the ones. The key book, if you want to learn about the Menzies Liberal Party, isn't Judith Brett. It's Gerard Henderson's Menzies Child, which says it all, really, the name. Then Anne went back and wrote about Enid Lyons and then Joseph Lyons, again informing the evolution of the party, the United Australia Party as it was, but part of the liberal tradition. So we owe it to the Hendersons the interpretation of the Liberal Party as we have. So we're very fortunate to have Anne here to talk to us about Menzies at War, but also to make her book available for us, because these things aren't so easy to get in London. You don't have to pay the Amazon mailing cost if you buy it tonight. Probably get them a bit cheaper. Over the back there, lots of copies. And Gerard is perfectly happy to take the money. I'll just mention that passing. I'm sure others will later on. So we're very fortunate to have the Hendersons with us at the Sydney Institute, but doubly fortunate to also have, as it were, a living member of that tradition and exponent of it with us in the High Commission, Alexander Downer, who was the longest serving and probably will always be the longest serving Australian Foreign Minister. In Liberal government, 11 years as Foreign Minister, extraordinary achievement, distinguished years. Before that, was leader of the Liberal Party, and of course been in liberal politics for a long time. So he could interpret the story for us, and will do shortly in the introduction of the book. Alexander Downer, of course, not only in his own life an exponent of Australian liberalism, but is in a tradition of it through his DNA. Father was High Commissioner here, a minister in the Menzies government, Minister for Immigration in the 50s, and his grandfather was one of the fathers of Federation. The Australian Constitution was drafted in the ballroom in his house in Adelaide, one of the key documents drafted in Sir John Downer's house in Adelaide, so now St Mark's College. So we now have the living proof, as it were, of the evolution of the Australian Commonwealth with us and the liberal tradition that comes within it. So we're expecting great things, Alexander. And we have to be kind to him because we're in his bailiwick here, of course. This is his official house in Australia. It's ours too, for many of us. But it's wonderful to introduce Alexander Downer here and to have him, this unique occasion really, to launch this very important book. Alexander.
Well, thanks very much, Carl, and Anne in particular, Gerard, and ladies and gentlemen. First, let me, well, thank you for your introduction. It's, as I just whispered to Anne, true to say that these days we don't have a ballroom. That's a bit of a shame. I'm not quite sure what I'd do with a ballroom.
You gave the house away.
I'm sure he sold it and give it away. That wouldn't be in the Downer tradition. I want to thank the Menzies Centre too for tonight. I think the more joint things we can do together, the better. I want to see the Menzies Centre really prosper, and I think under Carl's done a great job over the years, and with Ian taking over now, I think he's going to be able to continue that tradition. Because we do want to project Australia into the United Kingdom, Australian arts, Australian literature, and of course Australian politics and history, and so much of our history is tied up with the history of the United Kingdom for very obvious reasons that don't need to be expounded by me. I'm delighted that Anne has written this book. It's one of two books that has come out very recently about Sir Robert Menzies, the other being a magnum opus by John Howard, the former Prime Minister, on Menzies, which, although I've read most of this book, I have yet to start reading this book. And this time next week, well, in 8 days' time, I will be with John Howard at the launch of something in Adelaide, and I still won't have finished his book. It's so huge that 24 hours on a plane isn't going to be enough to get through it, I don't think. But nevertheless, I think... the Hendersons, the two of them, have done a great job in helping to draw together some of the threads of Australian political history. And Carl's mentioned that Anne's book on Joe Lyons has brought back to life somebody who, extraordinarily, considering the time he spent as the Prime Minister of Australia, and during that period after the Depression, through the 30s, a pretty difficult period for anybody to be the Prime Minister of any country, is somebody who is largely ignored in Australian history. The people who are remembered tend to be the people about whom much is written, and there are reasons for that. So a lot is written about Curtin, and Chifley was briefly the Prime Minister and tried to nationalise the banks, and imagine if he had remained the Prime Minister, what a different sort of country Australia would be today. As a High Commissioner, of course, I soar way above the grubby world of politics, so I make no value judgment except to say that Australia would have been a very different country if all our industries had been nationalised, a very different sort of country than the country it turned out to be. And of course, well, you know, we had this week, a commemoration, really, is the best way of putting it, of the life of Gough Whitlam, who was certainly a towering figure in Australian politics. But Joe Lyons, you don't hear very much about at all, and it's great that she's produced the book, that book, not this one, that one, and Dame Enid Lyons, of course, she wrote about as well before that. This book, let me encourage you to buy, is a fascinating study of Menzies As I see it in three ways. There are three themes that come through to me from this book. The first is actually Menzies the person. So there have been people who have endeavoured to create and often create a caricature of Menzies. You know, one of the observations I make about my own country is Australians are incredibly warm and friendly and natural people, but gee, they're incredibly partisan. They barrack for their side of politics, like they barrack for their football teams or their cricket team. All the Liberals are dickheads, or all the Labour people are jerks. And they just can't find it in themselves to be slightly generous to somebody who comes from the other side of politics to the side of it. Not even slightly generous. I mean, people on the other side of politics, let me remind you, aren't part of the human race. And Menzies was part of the human race. So there has been an attempt by some to create an image of Menzies as an austere, remote, almost sort of quasi-aristocratic, aloof figure. He was certainly a big figure in more ways than one. But he wasn't any of those things. He's obviously, his pedigree was not aristocratic, to say the least, coming from Japarit, as he did. Not a very aristocratic sort of a town. Vintage apparent, mind you. I'm entirely sure. Why would you go there except to see a little primary school that Sir Robert Menzies went to in his early years? I'm sure there's something else there, but not a lot. Somebody here from Japara? No, of course not.
Nearby.
And it's of course in the heart, not of Liberal Party country, but the heart of National Party country. I would imagine just about everybody in Japara would vote for the National Party. Not for the Liberal Party. Liberals wouldn't often run candidates there. Menzies was, and Anne's book says a lot about this, was a very warm, family-oriented person, very devoted to his family, as you can see through this book, to his parents, very close relationship with his father, his siblings, and as time went on, with his children, and just for some period of time as well, his grandchildren, who he was very fond of. So I saw this side of Sir Robert Menzies because, as you heard from Carl's introduction, my father was in the Menzies cabinet and was in Parliament with Sir Robert Menzies for many years, and was very close to Menzies. Menzies used to come and stay with us in South Australia. We moved here when my father became the High Commissioner. When Menzies retired in January 1966, he became, if not instantly, soon after that, the Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports. And he used to come over here, I haven't got time to explain what that job involves, it's a ceremonial position. I had a lovely apartment in Walmart Castle, I remember well. Used to come over here every year during the summer, and he would often come and stay with us. And what impressed me about Sir Robert Menzies, this grand figure, this man who had presided over the Commonwealth of Australia for a longer period than anyone else in history, and that's a record I'm pretty sure never will be broken, his period as Prime Minister. He was so engaged with people like my sisters and me as young people. So he didn't just sort of luxuriate in a huge armchair, though he did luxuriate in a huge armchair, but he didn't just luxuriate in a huge armchair and talk to my parents and the other grandees they brought around. He would sit there, yes, with a huge cigar, which he would smoke. Imagine that these days. There would be some, the police would be called, I suppose, nowadays, but smoking a cigar there and talking to my sisters and me about our studies at school and exploring the courses that we would do and showing such an extraordinary interest in our lives. I mean, I tell you all of that because, not to tell you anything about me, but to tell you a lot about Sir Robert Menzies, that this was an incredibly kind man. When we used to go to Canberra for our school holidays, he would invite me to go around to the lodge and played cricket with his nephew. He had a nephew called Alec Menzies. And there was a cricket net in the garden there at the lodge in Canberra. I don't think there is one anymore. It's probably been replaced by a gym these days or a static bicycle. But in those days, there was a cricket net. And so he would occasionally turn his arm over, which was always good because he was pretty easy to hit around the net. And but this nephew of his and I would spend hours and hours during the school holidays playing cricket there at the lodge, all courtesy of Sir Robert Menzies. So I spent a bit of time on this, but Sir Robert Menzies was an incredibly kind and generous and charming, although very grand, and slightly formidable, slightly frightening, particularly for a child and a teenager, but a wonderful man in that way. And with a huge interest in football and cricket, as you all know, we spend a lot of time talking to you about asking you questions. It's interesting that somebody in that position asking you a lot of questions, you not just asking him, you know, what's it like being Prime Minister and what do you think of the Suez crisis or whatever it was, him asking you questions about who do you think Australia's greatest left-handed batsman was. I remember him asking me that question once, thinking, gee, that's a tough one. Neil Harvey, I said. I think you got it right. Was Neil Harvey left-handed? Yeah, he was. and he thought that was a really good answer. And to be told you gave Sir Robert Menzies a good answer, that made you feel good. I think the second thing is Menzies at War is a great title for this book, obviously refers to the Second World War. But when you read the book, it reminds you that it wasn't only the Nazis and the Japanese that he was worried about, it was the Country Party and some elements of the UAP. And the huge wars he had with his own side of politics, you know, redolent of that expression you hear so often in politics that your opponents sit opposite you but your enemies sit behind you. It's a very good saying, as one I can very well, having been the leader of the Liberal Party, I can well identify with. I remember their names and addresses so well yesterday. I still see them on TV from time to time. The struggles he had, I think what strikes me is the struggles he had with the Country Party, the famous, incredibly personal, brutal, actually, frankly, utterly defamatory attack on him by Sir Earl Page. Now, I once gave the Sir Earl Page lecture at the University of New England, and I chose not to talk about any of these events and not much about Sir Earl Page, because it was a, you know, himself had a great war record from the First World War, Sir Earl Page, but calling Menzies a coward for not having gone to the First World War and so on was a pretty terrible thing. And I think Menzies was, and the book brings this out a bit, but I think Menzies was for the rest of his life very hurt by that. There was the redoubtable Archie Cameron, came from my own state in South Australia. Archie Cameron's electorate included part of what subsequently became my electorate. He was a Country Party man. He gave Menzies a pretty hard time as well. And then, I mean, it seemed during the early part of the war, the person Menzies got on best with was John Curtin. He seemed to have a better relationship with him. Which is quite impressive, although, of course, he eventually fell to Curtin and was plunged into political, albeit short-term political obscurity. The thing about Menzies is, though, he was pretty resilient. So during that rather short period of his prime ministership, he had good reason to be resilient. He had to help organise Australia to fight a war, and importantly, he came over here. And there's much that's been said over the years about Menzies' relationship with Britain and what he did while he was here. And was he more British than the British, or did he aspire to be British, or was he too much of an Anglophile, and should we look down on him for being an Anglophile? Well, he was a creature of his age, he wasn't a creature of this age, so we don't make any judgments about him and his attitudes to Britain based on the modern relationship between Australia and Britain, which is different from the relationship that existed then. This building, which was the first major building the Commonwealth of Australia ever built, and cost them £1 million, I think, in 1918. It's a huge amount of money in 1918. Is a symbol of what Australia felt about Britain. This huge building here in the middle of London. So Menzies felt very strongly about Britain. But I've always argued, and I think Anne essentially argues this in his book, in her book. I've always argued that Menzies was a very deep patriot, in fact. He wasn't somebody who put Britain's interests before Australia's interests, but understood the importance of Britain to Australia and, of course, the heritage of Australia, of Britain in Australia. He understood all of that. He was very proud of his Scottish, although it was only partly Scottish, but his Scottish ancestry played up his Scottish side a lot. The thing which is quite striking about Menzies in Britain is the slightly difficult relationship he had with Winston Churchill. I think it's probably a perception that he just formed before Churchill when he came over here. He rowed with Churchill, and he didn't row with him very successfully, by the way. He didn't get his way with Churchill. But the relationship was never as close as it was often portrayed. So Menzies, on his way over here in 1941, January, February 1941, went via Singapore and was horrified. Often he talked about this in subsequent years, horrified by the lack of proper organisation there was to defend Singapore. Now remember, this is what, 9 months before Japan entered the Second World War. But Menzies was very worried about the imminent Japanese entry into the war. And although it's often said people like Menzies and Chamberlain and the like, and by the way, John Curtin, just in case you're wondering, were appeasers during the late 1930s, and that's a very interesting debate. We look down on them, don't we, from a huge height, patronising height. We know what happened subsequently. They didn't know what happened, but they knew what happened during the First World War. They would have been very, very informed by the sheer horror of the First World War when they thought about the prospects of another war. Well, in any case, Menzies became less appeasement-minded after the beginning of the Second World War, after September 1939, in relation to Japan. Became very hard-headed and tough-minded about Japan, and very fearful. Whereas the British government was working as hard as it could to try to keep, understandably, to keep Japan out of the war, and didn't think that the preparations that Menzies thought were needed to be made. So it ended up by being quite a tough argument, which he lost with the British government. And of course, then in February 1942, we all lost Singapore. My father went into a prison of war camp for 3.5 years as a result of that. So it wasn't all drawing rooms and ballrooms. So certainly wasn't in Changi. But the point is that relationship was tested in a lot of other ways. I just recall this from my father talking to me about Churchill. I think there's a generation of Australians there who are not quite as admiring of Churchill. I think in a way wrongly, by the way, but not quite as admiring of Churchill as people are today. And the reason they're not is that they thought, Menzies thought, people like my father thought, Australia, nice place, but not the main game. They're expendable. And I do think Churchill thought Australia was expendable. If you're an Australian, you could be excused for thinking that's not acceptable. If you're British, and Britain was hugely in battle, not alone, as the British often say, because Australia and Canada and New Zealand and others were there with them, and Indians and South Africans and so on. So Britain was not alone in its hour of need. But But in any case, the really interesting point here is Australia, I think, did feel terribly alone through that period, in particularly obviously after Japan entered the war, and by then the government in Australia had been through its transition. But it's an interesting thing to reflect on. So Menzies at war, he had a lot of wars. The thing about Menzies, and it's the last point I want to make, I'm spending a long time making this speech, but it's the last point I want to make about Menzies. He is an illustration of what you find in every really successful political career, and that is the capacity to recover from adversity. You can only succeed, probably in any field of life, but you can only succeed in public life if you can recover from adversity, because as sure as anything is sure, you are going to one day confront adversity. I can think of a politician, should remain nameless, of great talent, went through rapid promotions, and then when he, and for years he did incredibly well and was very well known and much praised around the land. But he finally had to confront adversity, and he couldn't. And that person never fulfilled his full potential as a result of that. Now, Menzies was absolutely shattered at losing the leadership, you know, and his, you know, everything went wrong for him. Prime Minister, the leadership, everything. The whole thing was just, you know, just felt alone. He thought of even standing for Parliament here. Anne has revealed more about that than I knew, so I'm quite interested in what she says about that. But here is a man who not only rebuilt his career, he rebuilt a shattered party, and he rebuilt a country out of the ashes of the Second World War. So he recast, a bit in the way John Howard did, he recast his personality a little bit and became a bit more generous with people. I think it would be true to say of the younger Menzies, he didn't suffer fools. I think, you know, he did come across as a bit, perhaps he was shy, but a bit aloof, didn't consult enough with his colleagues, didn't build those relationships a successful political leader has to build with his essential immediate support group, which is his backbench, have worked them. He realised that the second time he became the leader and ultimately the Prime Minister. And so he learnt out of adversity, he didn't collapse. I must say, must have come close to it. He got terribly depressed after his fall. Anyway, it's a great book, and I commend it to you. It's very well written. Extremely thoughtful and well researched. Is it biased? All books are biased. You can't buy an unbiased book. I think it's quite sympathetic to Menzies. On the other hand, a huge amount has been written about Menzies which is completely unsympathetic. And first to one of those books in her own book. Judith Brett has written off Menzies, and basically she is, of course, politically hostile to Menzies and Menzies' record and what Menzies stood for. So I, as the High Commissioner, am entirely neutral. I made a nice speech about Gough Whitlam the other day, and I extolled his virtues and ignored his faults. And in this case, I extol Menzies' virtues, and I'll think about whether there were some faults. There must have been, I suppose. But I said this of Gough Whitlam, I say it of Sir Robert Menzies, of course the Prime Minister for massively longer than Whitlam was, but there isn't any doubt whether you're Liberal or Labour, whether you're a huge partisan, that Menzies was one of the two or three greatest political figures in the history of Australia. Many would say he was the greatest Prime Minister we ever had. What did Paul Keating say, that when Menzies was the Prime Minister, these were the Rip Van Winkle years? Well, roll on Rip Van Winkle, because Australia did pretty well through those years. Wasn't a period of great trial for Australia. It was a period of great recovery from the ashes of the Second World War. So, Anne, thank you very much for writing the book. I'm glad to be involved in the London launch of it, and I hope that it sells hugely well. It goes on Amazon, and you can get it on your Kindle and all that sort of thing one day, I suppose. I don't know how all that works. But in any case, it's great to see you writing, continue to write, you and your husband, prolific writers, and long may you continue to be so. Thank you very much.
Good. You couldn't get any better than that. Thank you very much indeed. And now, author.
I'm not sure. It's a bit like a phone, sometimes I don't do that. Well, thanks very much to my commissioner and the High Commissioner and the Australian Solar Centre at King's College, who's done this book twice now, for being allowed to be here tonight in this really wonderful building. As I'll explain to some young people earlier on, built during the First World War, when I remember dying in France, at great cost, as a sign of our strength at the time. But also a building that Menzies would have known very well, because of the many times he would come here. And a building that saw romances such as Joseph Lyons and O.W. Hughes, later with John Curtin. But a building that was very much Australia's investment in its British heritage in many ways. I've come here tonight with Jared, a long journey, basically in very comfortable style by the US, half the planet crossed, and I can just say it was a whole lot more comfortable than the trouble that Robert Menzies went through to get here in January, February of 1941. And he came here for much more vital reasons at a time when Britain was in dire straits. For generations now, it pays to go and look at some of those photographs or to read some of the things that were happening to London. It was just appalling. And although not alone, because of its Commonwealth countries, we were the only ones supporting Britain, and Winston Churchill was making frantic attempts to woo the Americans to join him. And it was only even at that period, the early 1941, when they were even able to pass legislation to allow material support. So Britain was very distracted, Churchill was hugely distracted, and along came Robert Menzies. But he also had a vital mission, and he was on the Qantas Empire flying boat, and he hopped his way across the globe. I sometimes put up PowerPoints just to show this extraordinary flight. I'll have to go through where he went to. Across the top end of Australia, off to Indonesia, to Singapore, as the High Commissioner told you, and where he was shocked and horrified at just how undefended this incomplete base was. Through Burma, he stopped at all these places, India, Pakistan, Bahrain, Baziak, Tiberias, Jerusalem, because our troops played a very vital role in the Middle East against Syria, and saved the Jews of Palestine by defeating the Vichy French in time. Through Gaza and Cairo, we had important meetings because our troops were at that stage mainly based in north of Africa against the Italians and later with the Germans. Alexandria, trips into Libya, incredible flights to visit troops, and then to go via all the way around through the middle and south of Africa to come up the coast of Africa through Lisbon to get to Britain, which, because you couldn't cross the Mediterranean, it was too dangerous. By the time he got to London, where he was going to confront Churchill, persuade Churchill, because he was very much in that confident barrister personality that he was, that he had persuasive powers to bring Churchill's mind to his far-flung colonies in the Pacific. By the time he got to England, he was better briefed on the world situation than probably most people in Whitehall. He'd spoken, he'd been there, he'd seen what was happening. And he was accompanied on the flight through Africa by Chips Channon, whom Bob Carr back in Australia reminded us, looked at his wardrobe as the war broke out and realised he had 50 suits and said, well, I think that'll get me through it. He was very well off. and married to a Guinness heiress for our generation, that means something. And he enjoyed Menzies' company, as did Churchill, and invited Menzies out for dinner a couple of times while he was in London. But as the Australians left the airport call, he referred to the kangaroo party and disappeared. So we got our name very much, not only from hopping across the globe, but being kangaroo Australians. As I did this reading of Menzies' diaries, which he kept in that period of 3 months in London, it came to me, and there was an element of this in Lyons, but he was disadvantaged by the fact that you couldn't fly to Europe and America when he went in 35-37. But Menzies really is our first internationalist prime minister. Partly because you could fly and get across the world. Some people say, I've heard that this thing ever happened to Australians was the, you know, jumbo jet. But in these small aircraft, we could get there much faster than by sea. These were the days when prime ministers could leave Australia for 5 months to go to London or America. And Menzies had done this on the ships as well. So 4 trips to Britain and some to the United States before he became Prime Minister in 1939. So he was a globalist. He thought that way, which of course was most unusual for Australia, when our Labor Party was much more bogged down in social policy debates and to some extent on the outbreak of war, relatively many in the Labor Party quite isolationist. Now, as Menzies came into government, as Hope Mr. explained, politics in Australia was quite dysfunctional. Not only was the Country Party, by the time he became Prime Minister, because of Earl Page's dislike of him, rowing with the United Australia Party, as it was called then, and then not forming a coalition, so that he actually formed a minority government in April 1939 and told the Governor General he might last 6 weeks. On the other side of politics, the Labor Party was still fighting itself, which had kept it out of office for almost a decade. And in that period, 1939-41, it has been very common for mostly Labour-leaning historians, who have mostly written about these curtain and chicken years, to write Menzies off in 1939-49 as a total failure. Nothing was done. I mean, Keating could write the whole of the Menzies years, 1949-66, on this rip-van winkle. I mean, imagine what they drew with just 2 years. When his back was up against the wall. And that kind of writing, that kind of dismissing, I noticed when I started to do the work on Lyons. There's a whole chunk of Australian history that's just been passed over, forgotten, and they're really, really important years. Now, when Menzies came into office in April 39, by chance, because Joe Lyons had died suddenly, and he finally won the leadership, and he finally established his government, as the High Commissioner has mentioned, the world view was still very much, we can't afford another war. We mustn't have another war. It would be terrible. But by the time war was declared in 1939, later in the year, it became evident that there would be another war. And at that period, Labor was very much against sending any of our troops to fight the Northern Hemisphere theatre of war. So when Menzies put the troops on the ships and sent them off in early 1940, he did this against huge opposition from the Labor Party and those in the ranks who were very much influenced, some of them at the very fringes, by the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which was an agreement between Hitler and Stalin. So what Menzies did with his minority government, it was shortly after that the Country Party came around and realigned in 1940, but what he managed to do was quite heroic. He got our men to go and help fight the battle against Hitler, which the Labor Party would not have done. So if he had a Labor government after Lyons died, Australia would not have sent troops to fight Hitler. And that's why I'm trying to bring some of this stuff out, because for years, all we've ever heard about is, oh, Menzies was an appeaser, Bruce was an appeaser. You know, I looked at the other side. On the other side, there were members of the Labor Party who were supporting the Nazi-Soviet Pact, and there was for Kirby, who was in the middle of all this, he was dead set against, for many months, sending our troops offshore to the Mediterranean theatre of war. So that was the first of Menzies' achievements. Coming to Britain, of course, as the High Commissioner said, he wasn't falling all over Churchill, but he did go to his house many times for dinner because Churchill loved his conversation. But it was a tussle. An Australian Prime Minister became automatically, as did a Canadian Prime Minister or a South African Prime Minister or a New Zealand Prime Minister, they became automatically part of the war cabinet. They had the right to sit in the war cabinet. And for many, many weeks, Menzies believed in that war cabinet, he might be able to persuade, along with Diggers and the Chickers and wherever, that he could persuade Churchill to think that the dominions out in the Pacific really were in facing peril. But he also believed that the safety of the empire was just as important to Australia as it was in many ways to Britain, because if Hitler, at that point, close to doing so, had taken London, and there was some suggestion, you know, already they were working out who'd be the head of the new monarch and whatever, had Hitler taken London, of course they had immediate repercussions for Australia. We would be Vichy Australia. So Menzies was clear in his brain that what was good for Britain was good for Australia, but what also was good for Australia was good for Britain. And he couldn't persuade Churchill to look our way. He did send two warships, they were both sunk later. But in this, there's a fascinating chapter when Menzies sets off to Ireland, first the north and then down to confront De Valera. Because he's got this rather romantic view of Ireland, having known Joe Lyons, whose father had come, family had come from Ireland, in our Australian way. You know, Irish Australians are reasonable people. You know, I'm a Protestant, he's a Catholic, but we can talk to each other. Ha ha, off he went. He found him very, very charming, but he was completely unaware, as Churchill was, of the kind of deep divisions and personal hatreds that were going on, and also the problem for De Valera, if he put his hand up to support those terrible, vicious Brits. So he had, it's a fascinating, I've spent a few pages on this because it's a fascinating visit, and he managed to give a parting shot to the Irish as he went. Because what I didn't realise was that during the war, people were doing their weekends in Dublin. Dublin became a place where you get silk stockings and nice cakes and a good steak, because they were getting stuff that the British weren't getting. So people made the money to go for a weekend in Dublin, perish the thought. And so as he left, he said he'd heard that they could only get brown bread in Dublin. But he thought, after what he'd been told when he was a child, that brown bread was better for you than white bread, so what were they complaining about? So in other words, what he was saying was, you're doing it okay, you know, but you won't put your hand up for those who are doing it really tough. So the history that's been forgotten means that Menzies has been written off as a failure and only regarded in any way as a success when he gets back into government in 49 and stays there for so long, because I think it was a long time to split the damage itself. But one other thing that Menzies did during this period, with this very capable head of his defence department, Frederick Shedden, who learned an awful lot about the civil service from Hanky, they used to call Shedden the pocket Hanky, because Hanky over here, the big civil service figure here, was much more superior. But he helped Menzies redesign the defence, the whole departmental backup for a government at war. And what comes out of Shedden's diaries, which John Howard jumped out when he found it in my book, is that Shedden, who went on to work for Curtin, says that Curtin was grateful and very, very thankful that the work that Menzies had done in those 2 years, when he finally became a war prime minister, the work had been done, and he wouldn't have been able to do it quite so easily in his particular kind of Labour colleagues if it hadn't been done. So Robert Menzies was no failure. He stared down his Labour opponents. He managed to cope with the Country Party, and that's another story in itself. And I recommend the Archie Cameron pages, because he was really quite well known in his own quiet way. And going back to the personality of Menzies, and I think Robert Menzies' family, didn't Robert Radical family, but I think Robert Menzies' family. And so coming to the diaries and coming to other glimpses of Menzies that we've been given in the last few years, partly through Heather Henderson, his daughter, no relation, a lot of Henderson's in her. Heather did a marvellous thing shortly after I did the Ian Glyons book. She rang me, because I'd gone to talk to her about Ian Glyons briefly, and she said after some time, and I read the book, oh the book, oh the book, she said, my mother never wrote anything, meaning she had brains and ability, but she never committed her memories to paper. And shortly after that, we heard she was going to release Menzies' letters to her in the 50s and 60s, and she did him the biggest service ever. What a daughter could do for her father. Because Menzies are very private, and normally would not let you see very close to their personal history. But in those letters, Heather managed to release the personality of her father, and then later she followed it up more recently with a small memoir where she added many anecdotes that give you a glimpse into this person who is not what Judith Brent described at all, an artificial thesis about a man who was apparently influenced by a dreadfully severe father and a doting mother who had a completely Oedipus complex and went on and on and on. So we've got a glimpse of Menzies, the personal, but in that I then was able to understand how he wrestled with that isolation and defeat after he resigned. At the back of the book I've put in, I don't think anyone's published it before, it's hanging around the archives, his own account of what led to his resignation, beautifully written, at the end of August in 1941. Read it because you'll also get some sense of Menzies' wit and humour. Software creative occasion. But he recovered, but I found out, writing the book, that at the beginning of 1945, beginning of 1944, before the Liberal Party was founded that year, a chance came for the Premier of Victoria to appoint a new Chief Justice. And according to John Paul, who interviewed the person who was Deputy Premier at the time, does with the Premier, Menzies allowed his name to go forward. And so had Dunstan, Country Party man, not been not a friend of Menzies, because Country Party used to work at the Labour Party in Victoria, and Menzies had little regard for Country Party in Victoria, had he chosen Menzies, that would have been the end. He would have gone away from politics and ended up Chief Justice of Victoria. So it's in this struggle that eventually he is moulded, and it's shortly after that period when he doesn't get that job, which nobody knew about until more recently, in this book actually, that he then can't stay still. The law is boring, and the Liberal Party is boring, not just with Menzies, with lots of other people. Loses the 46th election because New South Wales was not united, it was a complete big mess. John Carrick pulled New South Wales together with a number of other people, and the nationalisation of the attempt to nationalise the banks by Chifley from 1947 on, just threw a chance in his way and it didn't result. Plus the fact that some of the banking leaders were very political and they had to organise a government campaign. And so for 1949 convinced us into government. Doc Everett became the leader after Chifley retired a little while later. And Doc Everett was the second gift to Menzies because probably without that erratic leader, the Labour Party would be the split. So Menzies was on a winner, but he wouldn't have been on a winner quite the way he was if he hadn't gone through that decade, 1939 to 1949. It really made him. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.